Welcome, everybody, to the North Carolina Criminal Debrief. This is a podcast devoted to covering criminal law issues in North Carolina and beyond. I'm your host, Phil Dixon, a faculty member here at the UNC School of Government in lovely Chapel Hill. Joining me, as always, is my friend, colleague, mentor, and DJ, Paul Bonner, on the ones and twos. And as usual, it's been a while since I've been in the studio, but it's good to be back. We are here in the last week of April or so of 2026, and today I wanted to start with a couple of news items. I think the last time we talked about the status of state cannabis law, I may have mentioned then that there were efforts underway at the federal level to sort of finally remove marijuana from the list of Schedule I drugs and move it to a lower classification. That effort has accelerated recently, and the latest news is reporting that the reclassification of marijuana will be to a Schedule III, down from a Schedule I, may be happening as soon as this week. Regular listeners know Schedule I drugs are considered to have the greatest potential for abuse, no accepted medicinal value, and that just simply hasn't been factually true for marijuana for quite some time now. Many states and many other jurisdictions around the world permit some version of medicinal marijuana. Many states permit recreational marijuana at this point. North Carolina, of course, we're in this weird gray area where we have legal intoxicating hemp products that are completely unregulated, but continue to criminalize marijuana. I will note our governor has a task force examining sort of what to do with cannabis policy in the state, and they recently released their report, which ended up saying, we really think we should legalize recreational marijuana for adults and put a regulatory structure into place. We'll see if the legislature has any interest in taking that up. So far, we have not gotten any traction on even medicinal marijuana, but perhaps this federal reclassification will be a factor in potential upcoming state efforts to figure out something with our state cannabis market. Back to the federal reclassification, though. So North Carolina, of course, treats marijuana as the least serious of the controlled substances. It's classified as a Schedule VI controlled substance. That's as low down the list as it goes. Many other states, I think, basically treat it in a similar fashion. It is in a different category than your quote-unquote hard drugs like heroin, cocaine, meth, even stuff like Schedule IIIs that might be anabolic steroids or ketamine are considered Schedule III. So really, even putting it in Schedule III is still arguably an overclassification in terms of its medicinal value and potential harms that carries with it. And this does not have any impact whatsoever on federal criminal law, federal or state criminal law, that still prohibits selling or possessing or otherwise distributing marijuana. What it's going to immediately do, this federal downgrade to Schedule III, is make it a whole lot easier for people to research it. And that is something that is desperately needed for some of these hemp products, at least. But yeah, you needed a very particular and hard to come by DEA license to study Schedule I or II drugs, as I understand it. And even then, you were limited to only the marijuana grown at the government-run facility that I think is in Alabama or Mississippi. This reclassification to Schedule III will ease restrictions on researching marijuana. It probably also has a tax consequence for folks who are involved in legal marijuana businesses, as I understand it. And of course, we don't have anything like a legal marijuana business in North Carolina, excluding what's going on in the tribal area, in the Koala boundary, of course, like the sovereign Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians do have recreational marijuana. And they've begun with a medicinal marijuana scheme before that. But of course, here there is no such thing as a legitimate, as a matter of state law, legitimate marijuana business. But again, in many states, there are. Because of a provision of the IRS tax code, I think it's 280E, you cannot deduct any business expenses whatsoever that is related to the sale of Schedule 1 or 2 substances. If your money comes from any kind of involvement with transactions involving Schedule 1, Schedule 2 controlled substances, you're barred from normal business expenses. So you're a hemp company in North Carolina. Hemp is legalized under both federal and state law. My sense is hemp owners still can make regular business deductions. But had marijuana become legal in North Carolina and had it remained a Schedule 1 drug federally, if you ran a marijuana business, you wouldn't be able to deduct any of your regular business expenses like the rent for your store. I wrote a little bit about that in my winter 2026 cannabis update that I think I put out in January or February on the Criminal Law blog. I mentioned it again in the news roundup this past Friday on the Criminal Law blog. And I mentioned, you know, sort of from a factual standpoint, even Schedule 3 for marijuana might be a little high. Well, then this next item just sort of goes to that point. This past weekend, the Trump administration released an executive order calling on the Food and Drug Administration to accelerate efforts to review and potentially reclassify certain psychedelic drugs to combat what the executive order classifies as a quote-unquote crisis of serious mental illness in the country. Based on some news reporting I've seen, I think Joe Rogan might have had something to do with this. Joe Rogan is, of course, a famous podcaster and a proponent of psychedelic therapies. Apparently, he was texting with the president, and they arranged for this executive order to go out. So some of these drugs have already been designated as breakthrough therapies. Several are already being studied in clinical trials. This executive order specifically mentions ibogaine compounds. This week, have already put two of these substances on the fast track. One is psilocybin, of course, the compound from magic mushrooms. Psilocybin is being studied for its potential to treat otherwise treatment-resistant depression. And methylone, a compound known as MDMC, is being fast-tracked to be used in treating PTSD. And my understanding is that this is a compound closely related to MDMA, that is what is on the street known as ecstasy. In sort of looking into this, I stumbled upon a site run by the Johns Hopkins Medical University, Medical School, where they're doing tons of psilocybin research right now, and I believe into other substances as well. So this stuff is already being used to treat things like PTSD and severe treatment-resistant depression. So it sounds like these drugs, too, are usually classified as Schedule 1s. Here that makes a little more sense as far as where it fits in the scheme of things. Again, mushrooms probably objectively are not as dangerous as heroin or even cocaine, but certainly people can take too much of them and have negative psychological effects or engage in dangerous conduct because of their impairment on psychedelics. But for the most part, these are not drugs that you get addicted to in the same sense as like cocaine, heroin, fentanyl. But they are typically classified both by state and federal law as Schedule 1s. All of these are psilocybin, ibogaine, methylone, are all Schedule 1s under federal and state law. And if we were going to start trying to make these things available to people for treatment, much in the way that you see now ketamine available on a widespread basis, I mean, I get targeted ads for mail order ketamine therapy. And ketamine is also a recreational drug that is popular in some circles. It just simply wasn't an option for mental health treatment up until a few years ago. It looks like at least these categories of psychedelics will be reclassified potentially and will be potentially starting to be rolled out as an option in the mental health arena. Perhaps only tangentially criminal law related, but I thought those were interesting stories just to start us out with. For our first case, I'm going to talk about a Fourth Circuit case. It did take place here in the Eastern District of North Carolina, and it has to do with a person's reasonable expectation of privacy in their digital files that they share with, here it was Google Drive. But before I get into that, I would also just note, you know, we talked before on this show a lot about geofencing warrants in a case called U.S. v. Chatry. Chatry involved an unsolvable bank robbery where police got a geofence warrant and eventually located the suspect and got him. And a panel of the Fourth Circuit initially affirmed that as, I think, either as not a search. Like, you didn't need a warrant for it because it's not a search, because you voluntarily shared your location data with Google, no expectation of privacy. That then got appealed up to the Fourth Circuit en banc, and it produced, if my memory serves, each of the 15 judges issued a different opinion. So we had 15 separate opinions in Chatry from the en banc Fourth Circuit, and none of them agreed on, or you know, there was no majority. Lots of different reasonings. I think I talked about that, both the panel decision and the en banc decision. And I just flag for readers that that case is being argued at the U.S. Supreme Court today. So the Supreme Court granted review in that case. We are going to get, presumably, get some word this summer from the U.S. Supreme Court on geofencing warrants. Turning to other digital privacy rights, let's talk about Lowers or Lowers. This was decided March 10th in the Fourth Circuit. You really need a little bit of a background here. So Google is a big tech company. They host lots of things where, like, file storage services, email services, and they take certain steps to make sure that their platforms are not being used for storage or proliferation of child sexual abuse material, what we would formerly have called child pornography. And I'm going to use an abbreviation because that's a mouthful, but child sexual abuse material is known as CSAM. So when I refer to CSAM, that's what I'm talking about. So they, Google, take steps to try and keep this stuff off their servers. A big way they do that is through this process called hash matching. So when a digital file is uploaded into Google, the system, an algorithm in the system, basically analyzes the image pixel by pixel and then assigns a specific hash value. And that sort of is the value of the file. And it's just a random string of letters and numbers. It doesn't look like anything. It's just sort of randomly assigned. When you've got a hash value, it will sometimes, people then check it. If the system detects this might be child pornography, excuse me, CSAM, then they check it and they see if the hash value is similar to a known image of CSAM that's already sort of in the system. And while it's not totally clear, it was not clear from the record in this case how accurate that hash matching process is. In general, a match means that the two images are probably the same. They have this sort of bank of hash values of known CSAM images. So when somebody like you or me uploads a new digital file onto Google, the system sort of assigns it a hash value. And if they think it's probably CSAM, then a Google reviewer manually opens it and inspects the file and confirms. And these are people who've been trained to recognize CSAM. They've been trained in what federal law considers CSAM. And if they confirm it, then they identify it as such. They categorize the type of CSAM it is. And then they put that hash value into the database of sort of known images. And at that point, they make a report to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC. This sort of ongoing process allows them to identify it when somebody uploads the same image into the database or somebody uploads a very similar image into the database. The system is sort of supposed to catch that. If you get a match on a known file, sometimes they sort of repeat the process and say, we're still going to have a reviewer open this and check it. But sometimes sort of the match is enough and they'll skip the step of having a human review it and go ahead and make the report to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I think the thinking here is that, well, that the hash match is pretty reliable. And if it's a hash match, that means that same image was reviewed earlier by someone else. And so we don't need to check every time there's a match. But sometimes they check, sometimes they don't. When they make a report to the National Center for Exploited and Missing Children, they'll tell the center, hey, we did review this file, or we didn't, but we got the hash match. And Google warns all of its users, if you go digging around in the privacy policy, it says, hey, we are looking actively for CSAM on our servers, and if we find it, we report it to law enforcement. So that's sort of your context for how this is teed up. So in 2019, somebody with a certain email uploads 156 files to Google Drive. The system quickly flags this as likely CSAM. So it does go to a human reviewer. The human reviewer checks 31 of the files. Out of the 156, he looks at 31. Each one apparently contains CSAM, or seems likely to qualify as CSAM. So they go ahead and send the report over to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And they tell them, hey, we've looked at about 20% of these files. These are the ones that we've looked at. But note, you know, we didn't look at the other ones. So about 80% of them have not been reviewed, but presumably there was a hash match. So the worker at the National Center reviews the same 31 files. They do not open any of the unopened files. They are able to determine that looks like the IP address is from somewhere in Bedford County, Virginia. So they take all that information and they forward this report to the local law enforcement there in Bedford County. Bedford County apparently just sits on it for 6 months. They don't do anything with it. Eventually, an investigator begins looking at this report, and they send the internet service provider a subpoena for account information connected to this IP address. And look, these facts get twisty. I'm sorry. There's no helping it. Turns out the IP address was really in Chesapeake, Virginia, which is not in Bedford County or not in Bedford County's jurisdiction. So Bedford County closes their file and passes all this along to the Chesapeake, Virginia police. So a detective with Chesapeake gets it. And when she gets it, she opens up 3 new files that have not previously been opened. So remember, 31 of the 156 had been opened and reviewed. She opens 3 new ones. She seems to think, she confirms these 2 seem to contain CSAM. She did not have a warrant. She just opened the files. Based on what she finds, she does apply now for a search warrant to figure out, hey, whose email address was associated with uploading these files. That tells her it was a throwaway account. The email was created expressly just for uploading the files. It went inactive within 30 minutes after it had been created and was never used again. But it did give them a house with that account. They were able to nail down where, I guess, from the IP address. So the detective spends 4 months apparently surveilling the house, hoping to get a suspect, I presume. That struck me as weird. Like, you're doing surveillance on a home for suspected CSAM possession. It's not exactly like a drug crime where there's going to be drug traffic back and forth. And turns out that was not forthcoming of any new information. She didn't get anything from these 4 months of surveillance. Eventually, she takes those images that she had viewed and applies for a search warrant for the home, saying, I have good reason to think these images of CSAM basically came from an email account connected to this home. And when they execute the search warrant, they find a married couple living there. They've got 2 young children. They find a whole bunch, 10 digital devices, but there's no CSAM on any of them. But in talking with the police, the husband in the house reports that, hey, you know, my 21-year-old son did just recently move from our home here in Chesapeake to Raleigh, North Carolina. Chesapeake now closes their file and sends on what they know to Raleigh. Raleigh police and an agent for the Department of Homeland Security come and speak to the 21-year-old. And at first he says, I don't know anything about that email account. I don't know anything about, you know, these images that you're talking about, but sure, you can look at my cell phone and computer. Police then find some deleted 4 images of CSAM on his phone that had been deleted. So they decide to go back and re-interview the man while simultaneously using that information to execute a search warrant on his apartment. So they bring him in, they send the search team to his apartment, and while he's being interviewed a second time, they're searching his house. This time, he confesses, yes, it was me. I downloaded the CSAM from my parents' house. I put it onto a flash drive, and I transported that flash drive down here. Here's where you can find the flash drive in my apartment. You know, meanwhile, officers searching the house or the apartment find that flash drive. It has hundreds of other CSAM images on it, over a dozen videos of CSAM, and a external hard drive with more video and over 750 CSAM images. And I think what was a smart move by the U.S. attorneys here, they indict the defendant in the Eastern District for possession and transportation of CSAM. They don't charge him with anything from that Google Drive account. All of the charges relate to the images found on the devices in the defendant's apartment. So the defendant, of course, moves to suppress. He says, hey, remember, all of this flowed from that Chesapeake detective opening the three images that had not been opened before. She used that to get the account information. She used that to, you know, that led them to my folks' house, which led them to my apartment eventually. All of this is the fruit of the poisonous tree that flowed from the detective's act of opening these images that had not previously been reviewed by anyone. And that violated his reasonable expectation of privacy, according to the defendant. I don't have the district court judge's name in front of me, but man, they sure tried to sew this up tight. Their first basis for denying the motion was that the detective's actions here weren't a search at all. Given Google's privacy policy, they tell users, hey, we're going to look for this stuff. District court said, defendant, you just don't have any objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in your Google Cloud account. But it goes on, even if you did, you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy in the files themselves, because the files were sort of contraband. And quote, I'm quoting the district court, nobody has an expectation of privacy in contraband. The district court really got twisted up here, thinking that these digital files and their contraband nature was akin to a canine alert on the odor of drugs in the automobile context. That struck me as a poor analogy, and turns out the Fourth Circuit agreed. We'll come back to that in a second. As an alternative basis, they said, even if you do have privacy rights in your Google Drive, notwithstanding their privacy policy and warning, there's no way you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in digital files that are contraband. They go on for a third alternative holding and say, Google's private search here defeated any expectation of privacy that you might have had in the files. Because Google had already looked at some of them, the law enforcement was entitled to go do exactly that same thing again. Finally, almost finally, the district court assumed, for the sake of argument, that the search was unconstitutional. The district court pointed to a federal statute that requires internet service providers to report CSAM to law enforcement. And the district court believed that that meant they could conduct a warrantless search of the files. I don't know where the district court got that from, because I didn't think that's what that statute said. But it gives a fifth, I think, justification for denying the motion here, which is that even if I'm wrong about all of that, hey, look at all the intervening events here between the detective and Chesapeake's act of opening these three files and where we ended up. CSAM discovered in the defendant's Raleigh apartment. There are significant intervening events between the discovery of these suspicious images on Google servers and the eventual discovery of the evidence in the defendant's apartment. District court said, I think that is sufficiently attenuated to purge the taint of any illegality, and the evidence should come in. So his motion to suppress being denied, the defendant takes a plea, but preserves his right to appeal the denial of his motion. And a big win, I think, for privacy advocates, and kudos to my friend Raymond Tarleton, who had this case on appeal. The defendant still loses, of course, but the Fourth Circuit said, hey, that Bedford County detective's action of opening unexamined files, that was a search, and it violated the Fourth Amendment. But we agree with the district court that the exclusionary rule doesn't apply. So as you can tell, folks, I mean, this case is just jam-packed with sort of Fourth Amendment analysis and exceptions to the warrant requirement. So the court starts out by looking at, you know, does the defendant have a reasonable expectation of privacy in this stuff? And the parties sort of agreed that he has a subjective expectation of privacy. Hey, I thought it would stay private, and I hoped it would. So the court skipped over that. But, you know, then the question becomes, is that expectation of privacy objectively reasonable? Is it one that, you know, anyone would also think? And the court said, yeah, he does have an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy here. The privacy policy does not defeat that. The court said, quote unquote, every Google Drive user knows that Google may scan their files to see if they contain anything illegal. A user's knowledge that Google might occasionally sift through their files does not mean he expects that the government will have unfettered access to those same files. They talked about the seminal Katz case. It's like, yeah, well, the telephone company can listen in on your telephone calls back in the day of wired telephones, but that doesn't mean the government can listen without a warrant. They compared it to a hotel occupant. Sure, you might have slightly reduced privacy rights when you are a guest in a hotel. There's a housekeeper who can come into your room at certain times, and anything that's laying out in plain view, you know, might get you in trouble. But that doesn't mean the police can bust in without a warrant. And they said this is the same. A Google Drive account is no different merely because it exists in the cyber world, said the court. It is the digital equivalent of a filing cabinet, in effect. Government said in arguing that the privacy policy should defeat it, they pointed to another case from the Fourth Circuit where users in a government agency using government computers were cautioned by the government, hey, we're going to monitor your internet use, and we scan your files, and we're just telling you. The court said that's a totally different situation. If you're working for the government and you're on a government computer and the government tells you we're monitoring your internet usage, you really don't have an expectation of privacy in it. But Google is something else. Here, we think he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in his cloud account. So good so far. They also completely rejected the district court's reasoning on this. You don't have any privacy in the files because they're contraband. They said, district court, you messed up here a million ways. First of all, you assumed that this hash matching stuff was, quote unquote, exceedingly reliable, but nothing in the record showed that. You were basically yanking that language from other cases that have talked about hash matching, and you can't do that. More to the point, an algorithm hit or an algorithm match, a hash match here, is just not like a canine alert in the automobile context. The court, and I quote, says, you know, for one thing, appellate's files were not in jeopardy of being lost or destroyed. You know, with the automobile exception, that's the justification. It's like somebody could drive the car away. But that wasn't the case here. They say far from it. Google had already copied all 156 of these files. They'd already been sent to NCMES, which had then been forwarded to law enforcement. Law enforcement easily could have obtained a warrant before opening the files, and any delay would not have hampered the investigation. Clearly, there was not a big rush here. These files were instead hidden on a cloud-based storage system, a digital filing cabinet of sorts, and they were inaccessible to law enforcement. At the risk of stating the obvious, digital files are not automobiles. The two things are poles apart, and the Fourth Amendment treats them differently. End quote. As to the district court's private search reasoning, and this is maybe the most interesting part of the case, they said, hey, there is a split of authority among the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals here about whether a hash match defeats a person's expectation of privacy. Two circuits, the Ninth and the Sixth, have found that a hash match does not by itself overcome a person's privacy interest in their digital files. Meanwhile, the Fifth and Sixth Circuits have said that it does. Like, if that algorithm matches and says this is known CSAM, you just don't need a warrant from that point forward. So there's a big split already, two to two, on this question of what's the effect of a hash match by the Google algorithm in CSAM cases as far as the defendant's privacy rights. And the Fourth Circuit joins the Ninth and the Sixth to say the hash match itself is not enough. The hash match just tells you you've got a matching set of numbers. But again, we don't know how accurate that system really is. We don't know what its error rate is. And the hash match doesn't tell you what's in the files. You have to go look at the file to actually determine what is in it. You know, again, the hash match is it makes it such that is purportedly such that it is very likely to be the same or a very similar image. But without knowing the failure rate, the error rate, yes, not enough. So here it didn't tell you the contents of the files, and they say it's not enough to defeat the person's expectation of privacy. Remember, under private search doctrine, a private person's search of a thing, even if it's done unreasonably or illegally, that does not violate the Fourth Amendment because they're not a state actor. If I just go snoop around your desk and look through your papers and happen to find evidence that you're involved in some heinous crime, I can just turn that over to police, and police do not have to shield their eyes. They can see whatever I saw. But they can't go beyond the scope of whatever search the private person did. We saw this in a case a few years back at the North Carolina Supreme Court, State v. Terrell, that I believe Shea blogged about. And that was probably 4 or 5 years ago at this point. But the sort of seminal U.S. Supreme Court on this is U.S. v. Jacobson. That's 466 U.S. 109 from 1984. Google had looked at the 31 of the 156 images. It's arguably a private search. Certainly the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children did, arguably another private search. Had they looked at the 31 images that had already been opened, I think private search doctrine would squarely cover this. But because they can't exceed the scope of any private search, here they did. You know, when they started opening new files that had not been previously examined by any human at Google or NCMES, the court said, because this examination revealed information that the algorithm could not, the district court erred in concluding the detective search did not exceed Google's private search. It clearly did. And then the government had a clever argument that was like, well, somebody looked at these images before. Somebody looked at the hash matching images that were uploaded by a different user under a different account at a different time. And because the image itself had probably been seen by someone else at some earlier time, when the defendant uploads the same or similar image, that should already defeat his expectation of privacy. They weren't having that. They said, you know, the fact that Google might have inspected a matching image uploaded by a different user at a different point in time, Fourth Amendment rights are personal. That can't defeat privacy interest in the files that I personally uploaded. But at the end of the day, the court says, district court, you got to the right result eventually, which was suppression was not appropriate here. The deterrent purposes of the exclusionary rule would just not be served by excluding this evidence. They're quoting Utah v. Streif, the attenuation doctrine case from 2016, U.S. Supreme Court. And that rule says when the causal connection between the unconstitutional police conduct and the evidence that is discovered is really remote, or it has been interrupted by those intervening circumstances, suppression is unwarranted. Well, how do you determine whether that's the case? You look at a three-factor test. How much time passed between the illegal search and the discovery of the evidence? What, if any, intervening circumstances might have sort of broken the causal chain? And what was the purpose and how flagrant was any police misconduct that's at issue? And they said here, you know, the defendant loses on all three factors. 7 months had passed between the initial illegal search by the Chesapeake detective and the later discovery of the evidence in the defendant's apartment. Defendant here voluntarily submitted to 2 interviews, during one of which he confessed, and 2 searches of his phone and computer, which led to independent discovery of new CSAM. Each of these intervening acts, the court said, significantly attenuated the causal chain. I'd also note, I mean, it went through three different police departments, right? Bedford County, Chesapeake, Virginia, and Raleigh before we get to there. And again, not prosecuted for any of the images in the Google Drive, just the stuff found in his apartment. They didn't mention that, but I thought that probably might have been a factor. So here, application of the attenuation doctrine precludes suppression. Any taint from the illegal search dissipated by the time this was discovered. And given all of this ruling, they just don't address the district court's good faith exception argument, which I think was probably also very flawed. But still, you have to admire the district court for its layering of reasons to deny the motion. And it was right, ultimately, at least as to the remedy, although the district court was wrong in finding no Fourth Amendment violation. So we now join the Ninth and Sixth Circuits, and we think that this is likely to go up. You've got a 3-2 circuit split on this hash matching stuff now from the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals. You had that in the Chatry geofencing case where, you know, one circuit was saying you need a warrant every time for this, or all geofence warrants are always unconstitutional. Other courts saying they're not a search at all, you don't need a warrant. Well, SCOTUS took that case in a jiffy. And my guess is that this might be the next big digital privacy issue to come up for Fourth Amendment stuff. So keep an eye out for that. Really deep and rich primer on a lot of these Fourth Amendment analysis and Fourth Amendment exceptions. I thought it was a great case to read. Of course, I summarize these monthly when there's good cases to cover, at least, on the Criminal Law blog. So check it out if you like. So that was U.S. v. Lowers, folks, from March 2026, Fourth Circuit. I wanted to do one more Fourth Circuit case. Again, this one from the Middle District of North Carolina. This was from the February batch. Mr. Perez was a guy on federal supervised release in the Middle District. One of the conditions of his supervision was that he's required to allow the probation officer to visit him at his home and any other place he is, and to allow the officer to seize anything contraband that's in plain view. Now, Perez originally was at his old house, but he moves to a new house. And he tells probation that, hey, I've got a new house. This is my residence. He begins renting his former residence to his girlfriend, Miss Coleman. And Coleman, she puts the utilities in her name, she signs a year-long lease, and she and her minor daughter move in. Probation later gets a report saying that Perez is violating his supervision. He's dealing drugs, he's traveling out of state without permission, and they didn't think he was living at his new address anymore. There was apparently some information that an informant at some point had told somebody in the probation office that Perez had moved back into his old house with Coleman, his girlfriend. And there's some indication that a probation officer checked that and corroborated it at some point. But then, and I don't know how this happens, but there's no record of any of that in probation's files. And remember, these federal probation officers, I mean, a lot of them are lawyers. It's a bit more involved of a job, is my sense, and a bit more like law heavy, because they also do the sentencing recommendations than a state probation officer. But, you know, somebody dropped the ball, apparently. So there's no record of the informant statement that Perez has moved back in with Coleman, and there's no record that probation corroborated that fact, but I guess people thought that might have happened. Probation decides we're searching both these houses. They first go to Perez's new house where he's supposed to be living, and they find some prescription medicine with his name on it, but it has his old address on it. Not too weird if you just moved. There's a canine alert on his car, and they discover the car is equipped with a trap compartment, you know, sort of a secret compartment for storing drugs. This guy has 7 cell phones. He denies having any connection to his former address where Coleman now is, but they go on to search Coleman's house. It's not clear to me what they exactly found, y'all, but it sounds to me like they found some lemonade powder and thought it was cocaine. So they go into her cabinets, and inside a lemonade container, they find a white powder. and say, we think that's drugs. And there's more of that white powder in a big container under her sink. Turns out whatever it was, not contraband. But based on their discovery of suspected lemonade powder, and she's not consenting to anything. She's like, I don't want to agree to a search. Like, no, you can, you know, he doesn't live here. You can't search. They say, well, here's everything we just found at Perez's house. And we found this suspicious powder at Coleman's house. And they get a search warrant. They find a gram of cocaine and 2 grams of heroin in Coleman's bedroom, which isn't great. But, you know, that doesn't look like drug dealing amounts. But apparently Perez still, I can't tell where all this stuff was found. So it's hard to determine whether, you know, Coleman was just unwittingly staying at a stash house or if she was in on it. But there are $1,000 bundles of cash adding up to 25 grand hidden away in the house somewhere. There's a safe there. There's some guns, some ammo. Perez, the supervisee, he's got the key to the safe on his keychain. So they open that and they find a bunch of white powder, a bunch of oxycodone pills, digital scales, a money counting machine, a drug ledger, and a money bag. Not great. He's clearly using the house still to store some sort of instruments of drug dealing. What does the government do here? I don't know actually what happens with the criminal charges here, because this case is a civil forfeiture proceeding. This is where the government says, we're suing that $25,000. It's in re $25,000. Their theory being, hey, it's pretty clear this money is from drug trafficking. But so Perez and Coleman fight the forfeiture. Unlike in the criminal world, you don't get a lawyer for that. Once the government shows that it's likely the money came from drug proceeds, it's you, the claimant's burden to disprove that. So it's a totally different kind of proceeding. Obviously, there's been a lot of criticism of civil forfeiture proceedings over the years, especially the asset sharing model that is often adopted by local jurisdictions, where they find some money, they send it to the feds, and the feds send them back 80% of it if they get to keep it. You also can assert Fourth Amendment rights in these proceedings. So they say, hey, these searches were unconstitutional. They shouldn't be able to use any of this. This stuff should be dismissed. District court denies that. They find probable cause that the money is traced to drug dealing. So Perez and Coleman appeal and say district court should have granted our suppression argument. Court said, well, not so much as to Perez. You know, Perez is on federal supervised release. He knew he was subject to this condition and sounds like everything was kosher there. But when you went to Coleman's house, that was a problem. Probation was entitled to conduct a warrantless search of Perez's, you know, quote unquote, property, but his property does not include real property that is in the lawful possession of a third party. I quote, just as a landlord's property interest does not confer authority to consent to a search of a tenant's residence, a probationer's ownership interest does not permit officers to rely on probation conditions to search a tenant-occupied residence. There was some confusion about where is Perez actually living? Is he really at Coleman's or what? The government had argued, and the district court ultimately agreed, that, well, the government had at least reasonable suspicion to think Perez was staying with Coleman. This is a question of first impression in the Fourth Circuit. What is the legal standard for a probationary search of a third party's house? But they looked to the Ninth and Eighth Circuits and both concluded that officers need probable cause, not reasonable suspicion, the higher standard of probable cause to think that a probationer is living in some third party's home before they can enter it. And note, that's the same standard that's required to execute an arrest warrant for a person in a third party's home. If they have a valid arrest warrant and they have probable cause to believe the person subject to the arrest warrant is in your home, they can execute that warrant, but only on probable cause. So same here. They could search the tenant's house, but only if they had PC to think Perez really was there. They didn't. I'll quote again, we hold an officer must have probable cause to believe a dwelling is the residence of the court-supervised individual to initiate a warrantless search of the residence that's not known to be that individual's home. Here, they didn't have it. So the motion to suppress should have been granted. District court's order was reversed and the matter was sent back down to be tossed. So they keep their drug money, sounds like. I don't imagine that ended well for Mr. Perez, who again was already on supervised release, I believe, for earlier drug crimes. But again, a big sort of privacy Fourth Amendment win at the end of the day, notwithstanding the fact that it arose in this context of a civil forfeiture. Listeners, you all know these cases are not binding in North Carolina courts, but they can be persuasive. And they churn out these cases at just, you know, a record pace, and it's a really deep, thorough analysis. And that's why I like covering these cases. I like summarizing them. I like occasionally covering them on the show. And they're just light years ahead of where we are in terms of our state courts of getting up to speed on these digital privacy issues. The Perez decision, not really so surprising to me one way or another. I think that's probably correct. You need at least PC to go in a third party's home. But this stuff about Lowers and the Google Drive, I mean, we just haven't gotten those cases yet. So I hope, if anything else, when I cover these, it gives you all, especially you defenders out there, some ammo and some ideas on how to challenge these kinds of searches and how to get it preserved so that it's up there. I had hoped to do two more, but I think we're getting tight on time. So I'm going to end with a state Supreme Court decision, State v. Thomas from March 20th. This is authored by Chief Justice Newby. And this has to do with, when can you be sentenced more harshly after a successful appeal? I think it's sort of black letter law for many of us practitioners. You can't be punished for successfully exercising your rights. So if I successfully appeal my conviction, I get a new trial, but I'm convicted again, generally can't be given a more harsh sentence. There are some exceptions to that, but generally, and we have a statute on it, it's GS 15A 1335, that says that, you know, hey, you can't give the guy more time just because following a successful appeal. And that really is meant to codify the U.S. Supreme Court decision in I think, North Carolina v. Pierce, that sort of established or vindictive prosecution rule. But North Carolina courts have treated this vindictive prosecution stuff very narrowly. It really has not been expanded into other contexts. Here you had an interesting situation. I think the facts are just kind of funny here. This defendant in 19 goes pro se and is tried on a whole bunch of motor vehicle and credit card theft offenses. He apparently beats some of them, but he's convicted on 13. And the judge decides, I'm going to put him into two judgments. I'm going to consolidate everything into two judgments. He's habitual. So one is felony larceny, classified as habitual felon. He's a record level 3, so he gets 67 to 93 on that. The second one was breaking and entering motor vehicle, habitual, again, record level 3. He gets 26 to 44 on that. Now, the defendant goes up on appeal, and he gets a new trial. The Court of Appeal says, new trial, you actually messed up, trial court, by accepting his waiver of counsel. You shouldn't have let him try his own case. Or you should have done a better job of explaining the consequences to him of waiving his all counsel and proceeding pro se. But this guy does even better the second time around. And it's not clear to me whether he had counsel or not. First time he's convicted of 13 counts on retrial, he's only convicted of 8. But the trial court does mostly the same thing. They again consolidate into two judgments. He again gets 67 to 93 months on the first one, just like he did in the first go round. But the second time, for the second judgment, the court realizes, hey, he already has a breaking and entering motor vehicle on his record. And that means he gets the bonus point for all of the elements of the current offense are included in a prior conviction. He had that at the time of his first sentencing too. The parties in the trial court just didn't catch it. So instead of getting that 26 to 44 that he got the first go round on the second judgment, he gets 30 to 48 this go round. And what does the defendant argue? Hey, this violates that statutory protection in 1335. You can't give me more time following my successful appeal. This is vindictive. It looks like you're punishing me. The Court of Appeals denies them relief, and ultimately the Supreme Court, a divided Supreme Court, does as well. They said, look, this is really as simple as there's a conflict between the structured sentencing rules and 1335 as applied to this case. You know, you generally cannot punish more harshly following a successful appeal, but you do have to follow structured sentencing. It's mandatory, and where the defendant qualifies for a bonus point, he should get it. So his first sentence, the court said, was illegal, and the judge was not required to continue perpetrating an illegal sentence. They were required to correct that mistake, 1335 notwithstanding. You had to do the judgment to conform with structured sentencing, and while you normally can't do it this way, the court said this is one of the rare instances where correcting an illegal sentence is required, even if it means you're going to do a little more time this go round. I would note that Justice Riggs penned a dissent that was joined by Justice Earls, and Justice Dietz also dissented from this case, so the court was 4-3 on it. I think this is not something that is likely to come up a whole lot, but in my experience as a practitioner, those bonus points, and that's not the only one. There's one for if you're on probation, parole, or you know, supervised release at the time. There's one for if all the same elements of the current offense are included in a prior conviction. There might be another one or two. But those get missed all the time. The parties are often concerned with just trying to get the record right. For somebody like, it sounds like this defendant is being tried on a bunch of charges. He's already a record level 3. Oftentimes, the convictions, when listed out on the worksheet, it's like 10 convictions from this day in this county, you know, 5 more from this day on this county, a bunch of different district court ones, different dates of superior court. So just trying to calculate the record level is often something that we attorneys are spending a lot of time on. The DA says, here's what I think it is. And then I go through it with my client. He says, that's not me. Or, hey, those are actually the same day, same term of court. You can only count one. Or this one doesn't count at all. So the bonus points get missed. Apparently, that is going to be justification on any kind of resentencing to increase the sentence on appeal. So following appeal. So just beware. Again, hopefully not something that comes up a lot. Listen, folks, it is a pleasure to be back. I will try and make sure you don't have to wait so long next time. Big thanks to Paul Bonner, my studio technician. Big thanks to Monica Yelverton, my associate director. Big thanks to the kind folks here at SOG and IDS that helped make this show possible. Thanks most of all to you. If you have questions, concerns, comments, you want to give me some ideas on stuff you want to see covered, please shoot me an email, dixon@sog.unc.edu. Again, that's dixon@sog.unc.edu. I would love to hear from you. I hope to talk to you again soon. Take care, everybody.